Good morning. I wonder, is the mic working? Can people hear? Okay. All right. So, in my last talk, last weekend, I talked about intimacy and attachment. And I talked about the fact that attachment is really important. Heart connection attachment is really important as kids and as adults and as practitioners until we die. So, and the attachment that we, the bonds that we establish with big people when we're little make a huge difference to us in our lives. And if we don't establish these bonds when we're little, then we work on establishing when we're big until we die. And it's a continuum. It's a continuum. So attachment is, contrary to what some Buddhists might say, attachment is very important. It's heart connection. It's intimacy. It's interconnectedness. And I also said that there are forms of attachment that get in the way of this intimacy. And this is really what Buddhism is aiming at. The ways in which beliefs get in the way of intimacy. The way in which self-image and trying to perpetuate it gets in the way of intimacy. Divisive language and control. So today I'm talking about intimacy and control. So we're rigged, our psyche is rigged to want to manage more pleasure and less pain, right? More pressure, less pain. And we're trying to do this for our whole lives. And yet, lots of things are out of our control. Aging, sickness, dying. I fell off my bike 3 days ago. Well, I used to fall off my bike every day when I was a kid. It was no big deal. Now, at this advanced age, I fall off my bike and my whole body just sort of... And I should have gone to urgent care immediately, but I didn't. I thought I was just a young person or something, right? So that's why I'm sitting here in this chair right now. We want to control these things. It's obvious. And it's the way we perpetuate our organism and the species. The problem is that the habit of controlling takes over our psyches, takes over our world, so that our whole identity is the controller. And then we don't have much presence. We don't have much freshness. We don't have much feeling of just spontaneous connection with each other. We miss that because we're trying to control. And when we're feeling anxious, that's a good time to notice the controller. Because the controller feels like he or she doesn't have together when we're feeling anxious. We thought we knew how to control, but we can't. So we just get more and more tight. More and more tight. And we use our thinking, we use our planning, we use our worrying, we use our obsessing. And I like to repeat, we do rehearse, regret, repeat, rehearse, regret, repeat, over and over again, tighter and tighter, and not in the moment much, just in our trying to control. But it is possible for us to respond and to live from a deeper, wiser, more compassionate place. Not always, but sometimes. A lot of the time. A whole bunch of the time. Tara Brach, the Buddhist teacher, quotes from Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff. And I don't know how many of you read that book or saw the movie, but here's a quote. Tom Wolfe describes how in the 1950s, a few highly trained pilots were attempting to fly at altitudes higher than had ever been achieved. The first pilots to achieve this challenge responded by frantically trying to stabilize their planes when they went out of control. They would apply correction after correction, yet because they were way out of the Earth's atmosphere, The rules of thermodynamics no longer applied, so the planes just went crazy. The more furiously they manipulated the controls, the wilder the rides became, screaming helplessly to ground control. "What do I do next?" The pilots would plunge to their deaths. This tragic drama occurred several times until one of the pilots, Chuck Yeager, inadvertently struck upon a solution. When his plane began to tumble, Yeager was thrown violently around in the cockpit and did nothing at all. He plummeted toward Earth. 7 miles later, the plane re-entered the planet's denser atmosphere, where standard navigation strategies could be implemented. He steadied the craft and landed. So, in that situation, the only life-saving response that was possible was, don't do anything. Don't do anything. Take your hands off the controls. Take your hands off the controls. So what would happen if we just took our hands off the controls a little bit more than we do? Just a little bit more. What would happen if we simply attended to what's going on a little bit more? Just being here without doing anything. That takes courage, right? That's the courage. Courage. And each time we let go, it's a little easier to re-enter the warmth and spaciousness of this open heart each time. But don't make a big project out of it. It's not something to control, right? If you start making a project out of it, then you're controlling it. So how much of our lives do we spend navigating obstacles, solving problems, worrying, rehearsing, regretting, repeating, regretting, repeating, rehearsing, over-controlling? And the effort to be in control is chronic for most people. It's chronic for most people. So one of my favorite Greek myths is the myth of Sisyphus. So Sisyphus, some of you know Sisyphus, you heard me talk about Sisyphus before. So Sisyphus' life was, he pushed this great big boulder up to the top of the mountain, and then what happened when it got to the top of the mountain? It rolled down, and what did Sisyphus do? He went after it, he pushed it up, it rolled down. That was his entire life. That was his entire life. So his effort to be in chronic control meant that he didn't feel fully connected or alive with anyone, with anything. So we lose connection to our own creativity, to our natural intelligence. And we can't feel even our own sadness or our own yearning because we're focused on pushing the rock, and grumbling as we do it. You should be different. I should be different. The rock should be different. The rock should, when I finally get it up to this top, it should just stop. It shouldn't come rolling down. But here it is, rolling down. But what about if we just go with it? What about if we just go with it? Should the over-controller creates separation from even those things, those people, those activities we most deeply care about. And the mirror image of the over-controller is, as I was saying last time, fake go with the flow. Fake go with the flow. My friend Larry in the 70s, his way of being controlling was just to say, oh, everything was just taking care of itself. I won't take responsibility for anything. I'll just show up and have a meal with you guys and then go out to my yurt, which is raining in the yurt, but I'll just have pans. I don't mind the rain. And then he never took responsibility for anything. He was just being a Taoist. which is fine. But he was escaping from this issue of control by under controlling, by being a fake Taoist. And he didn't even know it. Or we withdraw. I can't control. I'm going to withdraw. I talked about this last time or the time before I talked too. I couldn't control this guy who was the head of practice in San Francisco Zen Center. I felt like I couldn't control him. He was just beyond my control. And yet I wanted him to pay attention to me, so I just withdrew. I just left that Zen Center. And I went to practice on my own. But, you know, we're always with people. We're always with life. We can't withdraw from life. Even when you're practicing on your own, you're with someone, you're with something. So that kind of spiritual bypassing that I've been talking about the last few times is not so healthy. Not so healthy. So, in our practice, it's possible for us to relax the over-controller or its mirror image, to shift subtly from controlling, from wanting, from fearing all the time, into some sense of spaciousness, some sense of largeness, some sense of openness. It's possible. It's possible. And of course, when you hear me say this, or when I heard my teacher say this, then I related to the over-controller from the over-controller wanting to crawl. Oh, I should do more zazen. That's what I should do. I'll hang out with Suzuki more. I'll hang out with him all day. I'll just do zazen. So the over-controller is over-controlling the over-controller, right? Not releasing. But it's possible to release at any time. At any time. From a space of open-heartedness. Sinking into a space of open-heartedness. And when we change, when we try to control others or change them, lots of times there's conflict and resentment, and there's no intimacy. There's no intimacy. And we have good intentions, but the good intentions don't go anywhere as long as we're grasping. I want to give unsolicited advice to Matt. Matt's sitting there. I want to give him unsolicited advice about how to wear his rocker suit. And how to color. If he's not going to wear black, at least coordinate his colors with his rocker suit. But when I give that unsolicited advice to him, it pushes him away. He feels just by me. He doesn't feel close to me. He doesn't feel like there's any interdependent flaw between me and him. Who likes to be told how to act in matters of the heart? Who likes to be told how to act in matters of the heart? When we try to change someone, we're in effect saying, that person's not good enough. Matt, you're just not good enough as you are. You're not good enough. You're only a priest, not quite even a priest in training. You've got plenty of time for Ted and me to shape you up. And just because he's your teacher, don't forget I'm the guiding teacher. Right? We do that. Okay. We do that. But when we accept each other as they are, it brings people closer together. And when we try to control them, it pushes them apart. So simple. So simple. Acceptance, close together. Control, apart. We all know this. We all know this. The simplest things are the hardest often to just do, just be. So, to lose control is possibly to find intimacy. Possibly. To accept each of you as you are, instead of trying to change you. It helps you feel at ease and comfortable with me, right? And then we can trust each other. Think about your spouse or your significant other or your kids. Think about it. Think about those times that you've tried to control them because they just aren't doing things right and how it's moved you apart. Think of the times that you were able just to be there with them. Just to be there with them. And actually they start behaving then. Amazing. They feel deeply listened to. They start behaving. So friendships, the best friendships are the ones in which we accept fully, warts and all. Openness and intimacy without fear of criticism or judgment. So we can just relax and be ourselves. So they can just relax and be their selves. As we offer a little bit of TLC, a little bit of kindness, without pressure or too much expectation. Okay, so now I want to talk about decontrol methods to foster intimacy. We want a method that will help us get control. Everybody is always asking me for a method to help get control. Well, here are some decontrol methods to help you get decontrol. Right. And these are very simple-minded. They're very simple. When we care about a relationship, when the relationship is important to us, emphasize the positive qualities. Very simple. Instead of complaining or about the person or to the person or trying to change their annoying habits, think about what you like and you appreciate about them. It works. It works. We give people names here at Zen Center, Buddhist names, in our initiation ceremony, which we're doing. I've given lots of people names, but we don't give negative names. We give positive names. We give names that either reflect what we see in them or what we see in them potentially, because we want to encourage them. We want to encourage them to feel intimate with themselves in the world. So we give positive names. And we give our kids positive names. A name that reflects our aspiration for our kids. Maybe the way it sounds, maybe some relation to the meaning of the word, the family. We do this. We do this with names. Many of you know this. My Dharma name is Zentetsu, which means thoroughgoing Zen. Well, that's a name. That's a positive name my teacher gave me to encourage me. It actually confused me a lot, but it also encouraged me. Now I just think, fine, whatever. And my name that my parents gave me, Timothy. And I thought, just my name, Timothy. And people would be disparaging by calling me Tiny Tim and Tiny Tim the Tortoise and all those mean things that kids do when they when they've forgotten how to be intimate. But Timothy. And my grandmother said to me once, "Dear, do you know what Timothy means?" And I said, "No, Grandma." Well, I named Timothy after my grandfather and my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather who came here from Ireland during the potato famine. I knew all that stuff. So she said, "Oh, but dear, Timothy means honoring God." My grandmother was Catholic, right? Honoring God. And I said, "Oh, Grandma, but we don't believe in God." Me and my mother and father. "We don't believe in God." She said, "Oh, that's all right, dear. Just honor the God that's in front of you. Look at the grass. Look at the sky." I remember this really well. I thought, wow, what a cool name. What a cool name. Encouraging people's positive qualities. That's why we name them. So we can do that in daily life too, can't we? Simple, simple. A friend whom you love, but her idiosyncrasies just drive you nuts. Remember why she's your dear friend. There's some reason she's your dear friend. Remember that. Remember that. It doesn't mean you don't pay attention to the nuts part and give her feedback if and when appropriate. But not the not saying using nuts, because that doesn't usually give the kind of heart connection feedback that we want. Right? So that's the first one. Positive qualities. Second is listen attentively. Listen without advising, without giving opinions to your loved ones, to your kids, to your grandkids, to your parents, to people in the grocery store. Although I wouldn't listen too attentively to people in the grocery store who are very needy, because you'll find that they want to come home with you. Because people are starving for attentive listening. They're starving for it. They just want to be heard. They just want to be heard. That's all any of us want. So listening attentively, being able, allowing people to freely express themselves so they can process their issues and concerns, so they can get it out of their system. So my 8-year-old grandson now, I can't keep track of how fast he's growing up. My 8-year-old grandson comes home after soccer and he wants to tell me about all the times he hit the ball and how well he did. It seems to me like he's bragging. He shouldn't be bragging, but that's my should. If I just listen to him, I say, wow, Logan, that's good. Oh, and my body is with him. Then he builds some intimacy with Grandpa. I remember these things about my grandkids, my grandparents from when I was tiny. Just a couple times when my grandparents really listened to me, that stays with you. That stays with you. That supports you. I remember it more with my grandparents than my parents, because my parents were always trying to get me to shape up. I mean, that was their job. They had to control me. My grandparents didn't have to. They had this wonderful luxury. And the third one is moderate your expectations of others. Expecting too much from people fuels controlling actions that lead to disappointment and resentment, in case you didn't notice that. In case you didn't notice that. And don't look for your friend to fulfill all of your love needs. That's not his or her job. It doesn't mean you give permission to your friend to treat you thoughtlessly. That doesn't mean that. You just moderate your expectations. You modify your expectations. Check your motivations. Are you giving to your friend because you want to, or because you're expected to? And if it's just expectation and there's no heart connection, then maybe there's something you need to pay attention to in that relationship. Something, if it's just expectation. Just expectation. And people we care about will be there for us. If we don't expect too much from them, they'll be there for us big time. Big time. But this also means not expecting too much of ourselves. Zen students that I've worked with the last 20 years tend to be harder on themselves, this is a generalization, than on others. Harder on themselves than on others. So don't expect too much of yourself either. Just be with yourself. And I've been talking about we need shoulds, but only those shoulds that enhance our authenticity. Any shoulds that don't enhance our authenticity or our authenticity in relationships are probably just turning into rigid control kinds of shoulds. So the last one that I want to talk about, the last decontrol method, is Zazen. Anybody ever heard of Zazen? Zen meditation. Zazen. So here is Buddha. There is one thing. This is in Anguttara Nikaya. There is one thing that, when cultivated and regularly practiced, leads to deep spiritual intention, to peace, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to vision and knowledge, to a happy life here and now, and to the culmination of wisdom and awakening. And what is that one thing? It is bare awareness centered on the body. Centered on the body. Which is our meditation. I've talked before, but not much here, but I think it's in my next book that's coming out. Wanda will say for sure. Because she remembers my next book better than I do. Because I'm getting so old, I barely even remember Wanda's name. My prep for doing Zen meditation, I didn't know, was surfing as a kid. I grew up on the West Coast in California. I never surfed with a board. I did body surfing. But I surfed. I'm 5'6". I used to be 5'6" before I shrunk. And my friend Jerry was about 6'5". And we surfed. We cut out of school early every day in the summer to go surfing. He had a board. I just surfed with my body. I didn't have a board. And we would go to Santa Cruz, and sometimes the waves would be up. And when the waves were really up, I didn't go out to the big waves because I just surfed with my body. But he would surf with his board. And then when the waves were not up, he would come in and body surf with me. So that helped me prepare for Zen meditation. I didn't know it. Right? I didn't know it. So facing the contours of the waves. There was this famous Hawaiian surfer, Uncle Kurt, who said, talking about surfing, "We are all one. Nobody is better than anyone else. And the ocean will right size you because it doesn't matter if you are 7 feet tall or 2 feet tall. Whenever your feet leave the sand, we all become a single body mind floating free." Oh. A single body mind floating. So I experienced that as a kid. Sometimes wonder, awe, delight in the presence of this huge ocean and these waves. So what about sitting? What about sitting? Well, when the waves are really big, we need a surfboard. We need our breathing. We need to count our breathing or to repeat something soft with our breathing. It's not just enough to do bare awareness because the waves are so big. We need that. But sometimes we can just do bare awareness where our skin just feels the water, just feels the sensation and the emotion. And that's wonderful. Oh, there it is. One wave after another. Obsessing on problems again. Wishing for more or less waves. Does anybody ever wish for more waves? Surfers do, but not. I don't think Zen meditators do. Well, maybe some of you do. Yeah, I guess during retreat sometimes it's so boring. Got to have a little bit of fantasy going here, right? You have to do long retreats to know what I'm talking about. I think. I'm not sure. So letting go of the doing and just being in this space. The vast mystery of this ocean. This ocean. Feelings, emotions, thoughts, sensory perceptions without grasping or resistance. Fear, anger, joy, regret. The surface of an intense, dynamic aliveness underneath. Whether this surfs up or not. And then when we're in samadhi, they call this ocean seal samadhi. We're sealed by the whole ocean. It seals us. It protects us. So our sitting is training to experience the body from the inside out. The hand, feeling the hand from the inside out. Feeling the energy that is a hand without labeling it from the inside out. When sensations become unpleasant, our first reaction is to try to get away. Sure. But reconnecting to the parts of our experience that we habitually push away. Just letting the energy of the sensations and thoughts and feelings that arise just be there without trapping them. Naturally, after a while, it's the waves dissolve. Naturally, they dissolve. And then a new wave comes. Well, that's the nature of the ocean. That's the nature of life. So by making room for today's anger, sometimes we open the door to old buried anger, to rage linked to something painful that happened in our past. That's fine. That's nothing to get wigged out about. That actually means your meditation is going pretty well. You're pretty unrepressed. You're pretty open. You're pretty still. You're not just chattering. You're really feeling. Or a feeling of anger might turn into hurt or fear or loneliness. All happening in this big ocean. So I used to do one-to-ones with a woman I'll call Molly, who said that in her meditation, whenever she came to talk to me, she'd talk about how she had too many waves, too large, couldn't surf them. And plus she had cluster headaches that on and off the cushion she'd had for years. And when she began meditating, she thought her life was always going to be miserable. That she was flawed. She was flawed. She was a flawed self. Pain, flawed self, fearful self, depressed self. But then she kept practicing anyway, got discouraged, come in and see me and leave a little lighter, I think, and kept going with it. Simply feeling the sensations of the headaches she had as she was feeling them. And then she began to just be able to be present. The headache's still there, the pain was still there, but the flawed self just kind of dissolved. Because it was a made-up flawed self, right? Anything that we hold together with our controlling means that it's made up. And it can dissolve. On its own, it will. It just does. It just does. But in its own time. Not in your time. Not in my time. So in our culture, in Western culture, not just American culture, but European cultures too, we disconnect from physical experience. That's our heritage. Indigenous cultures, not so much. Indigenous cultures tend to be home, at home in the physical world, at home in their bodies. We tend to mistrust nature. No, we don't think we do, but our ancestors here in this country were scared of nature. They mistrusted nature. Nature could get them. They needed to control themselves. So we mistrust our bodies, our living, dying bodies. We try to kill the pain, control the pain, control and subdue the pleasure, the natural urges. But the body itself is exuberant and wild. I just watch my grandsons, 8 and 11. I'm wondering, when are they going to tamp down a little bit? They've been doing this since they were 2 and 6. Still, this wild energy in their bodies, always moving, always. But natural, right? Not repressed, just natural. You know, there was a time when my kids were kids where all boys who were exuberant were getting labeled ADHD. All boys. What was the deal? All boys are ADHD. What does ADHD mean then? all boys are boys. That's what it means. So they don't use the label much anymore. They use it a little bit, but time when my kids were kids, and everybody, all the boys between 6 and 13 were getting medicated for ADHD. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not entirely. But the body. In Zazen, our steady attention to the physical experience of an emotion, of past sensations linked to it, just being there with it and letting it de-repress itself, releasing charged pockets of historical pain, meeting new situations with freshness. Is that what that means? Release means freshness. Gentle attention to our bodies. As Rumi said, the cure for the pain is in the pain. The cure for the pain is in the pain. So now I want to lead you in a meditation exercise. Why don't you get in a comfortable position, because I'll probably talk for, I don't know how long this, probably 5 minutes or could be longer. So sit comfortably with either your eyes closed or slightly open, however you feel most at ease. Bring to mind a difficult or troubling thought or situation. Some situation that carries for you intense emotion, such as sadness, fear, shame, anger. See where you feel it in your body. See where you feel it in your body. What does it feel like? Can you experience it fully without immediately or anxiously working with these sensations to make them go away? Working with these emotions to make them go away. As you see the reactions in your mind, settle back and come into your body. Feel the different sensations being born of whatever the emotion is in this moment. If you find you're adding judgment, condemnation, future projection, anything like that, let go of those reactions as best you can, as though they were birds flying out of your hands into the air, and return your attention to the sensations of the emotion. Return your attention to the sensations of the emotion. You may experience moments of sadness, fear, frustration, helplessness. It really doesn't matter. Just bring your focus of awareness to the part of the body where those sensations are the strongest. Once your body has moved to the bodily sensations, once your attention has moved there, you might say to yourself, "It's okay. Whatever it is, it's okay." You might say to yourself, "I can feel this without pushing it away or getting caught up in it." Staying with the awareness of the bodily sensations and your relationship to them, accepting them, letting them be, softening and opening to them. Just watch them arise and pass away. None of these states is permanent, unchanging. They're moving, shifting, no matter what story or add-on arises. just come back to your direct experience. What are you feeling right now? What does it feel like? What's happening? What's its nature? And when you feel ready, you can open your eyes and look at me and come back to the room. And take a minute to quietly reflect on what was most interesting to you about this exercise. What was most challenging for you? Are there certain things that you learned that would be particularly useful to bring into your day? Into your work. So a Zen nun from the 15th century Japan asked what Zen was about, and she said, I meet life with my body. I meet life with my body. This dance of life is our body. This dance of life is coursing through our body. Hakuin, the Zen master Hakuin, a couple of hundred years later, said, this very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. The lotus land. The wonderful place of awakening. Always here. Sure, there are lots of waves. Sure, the waves are sometimes out of control. Sure, there's a lot of seaweed in the waves. That's part of life. That's part of life. So when we meet life with our whole body, that's our whole mind too. We're Buddha. We're the awakened one. Just as we are. Buddha's not some special being. It's special. It's special, but it's not some one being of special. It's the being of beingness. The whole ocean with all the waves, all the seaweed. So just to review a little bit, to experience deep intimacy and let go of trying to be over in control, we need to practice bare awareness in our bodies, which is Zazen. And we have a possibility to do some interpersonal practices, like being doing listening without being judgmental, deep, non-judgmental listening, modifying our expectations so that we remember that the relationship is not primarily based on expectations, it's based on heart connection, and focusing on the positive qualities of the relationship. And then Dogen's statement, to forget the self is to be intimate with all life, is pretty natural. Pretty natural. Pretty natural. So that's what I want to say this morning. And be glad to entertain questions or comments about anything related to what I've been talking about today or the meditation exercise. That meditation exercise is Sharon Salzberg's, if anybody wants to know. Sharon Salzberg. Some of you have read her. She's pretty good. She's pretty wonderful. Yeah.
So what you're saying makes a lot of sense on a personal level, but I'm wondering how we deal with this on a societal level when we see segments of our society behaving egregiously and we want to judge and control them.
Well, we shouldn't lose our discriminating mind. We need to, when people are hurting each other, we need to speak out. And right now, you're not trying to establish a heart connection with, I don't think you are, you may be, with the President of the United States. I don't think you're trying to. And when you're not trying to establish a heart connection with someone, and you think they're not capable of that, and I'm sorry to pick on him, but you know he's just in everybody's mind all the time. So you need to use your common sense, be discriminating, call out how people are creating suffering, how people are mean. From your sense of spaciousness and interconnectedness, call it out. Call it out. And, you know, whether you go on a protest or what you do, we need to call these things out. We can't just I said that the mirror image of over-controlling is running away or withdrawing. God, you know, I'm sorry to use Donald Trump, but I never want to hear about the guy again. I just want to withdraw. And yet I have some obligation as a human being who cares about the interdependence of all life, not to entirely withdraw, but to do something. I don't know what. For each of us, it's different. And, you know, I'm just using Donald Trump, but it could be anyone that you see who has power, who is abusing it, who is hurting people. So I just think that's important. So I'm really glad you brought that up. What else this morning? Pamela.
I love this question, and it has been feeling like listening out is what's being promoted as opposed to standing up and doing something about what's going on. And there's on NPR, 1A is asking, what did your faith community say? How, you know, are they ignoring it? Are they helping you to stand up? What's happening? So that program is happening tomorrow. What can I say about our faith community and how we're being led or taught to do something about what's going on, about the hatred and the fear and the violence that's happening in our country right now?
Well, that since we're, I'm just being redundant, but since we're interconnected with all life, when life is being abused or dissed, we need to act. We need to act. And that's just, I mean, I think it's that simple, Pamela. Do you think it's more complicated than that?
I'm wondering, in our community, how can we act? I mean, faith communities are doing things, you know, to be involved, to stand up, and so...
We're not doing anything formal in a political way right now. Some people would like to, some are not sure, and I don't know, but it's an open question. It's an open question. Yeah. And the question is kind of how to do it without dividing the community in two or three, but not to use the fear of dividing the community as an excuse not to do something. So I don't have the answer. So when you go tomorrow, you can't say that we're doing anything in an organized way, except that we individually are involved in a lot of things. We work with Joyce Food Shelf. We help people who are in prisons, and we encourage people to follow their consciences. But yeah, you could be part of a group. I know Ted would like to do this. Be a part of a group that organizes us to do something specific. But I'm open to that. But I also don't want to divide the community. So.
Yeah, I think that's what NPR is asking, because they're saying, how can we do it?
Yeah.
You know, what is your faith community?
Well, I think this community would have to decide that.
Yeah.
I think that all Ted and I can do is encourage this community to process that and decide whether they actually want to do something for me. And we've talked about this a lot in our leadership group.
Mm-hmm. And we'd love
do you to want hear, to say something more about
it? Yeah, we would love to hear from people with ideas about this. It's not easy to know what to do. I think we've addressed this quite a lot in talks about how to use our practice when times get really difficult to stand up and about the necessity of standing up. And you're talking about doing something in a more organized way, and I'd love to explore that.
Let's do it.
All right. All right.
Anything else? Yeah.
Tim, there is a support group that's calling ourselves the Support in Action Group.
Yes.
There's many NZMC members and some from other centers, too.
Yes. Yes, so Amy or Jim, would you like to talk about that?
Sure. It's a group that meets about twice a month, and we talk about our experiences and our ideas, and we share ideas of what we're doing to try to feel like impactful in our communities. And there's a sign-up sheet in the basement on the bulletin board by the bathroom, so if you'd like more information, put your email and name down, and we will get in touch with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, Carrie.
Thank you for this talk. I think it's bringing it back to the personal level. It's really important because if we aren't feeling it in our bodies, if we're not knowing what that feels like to be angry, right? Mm-hmm. What that feels like to be sad, it's going to be a lot more muddy when we go out to try to act.
Mm-hmm.
In any sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things that you spoke of, I've had a relationship with them before, and they've come up, and it's a really good reminder in my relationships with my children that how controlling I want to be to get them to do things. And every single time that I find ways to connect with them on their level, how this unwraps and unfolds so much more easily, and in personal relationships, the listening and just being there, that's a wonderful reminder to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
And even people that you don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's even the utmost importance to find a way to connect best of your ability.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carrie. Thank you. I think we need to move on now, you guys, so I'll turn it over to Carrie.
Thank you.